Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 1008.JH0406, certificate number 36525. Pumpkin pie.
What are you watching?
An ad for pumpkin spice coffee.
What does it taste like?
Pumpkin.
But pumpkin doesn't taste like anything. It's like squishy nothing.
That's what they put on pumpkin. To make it more interesting.
Spooky faces.
You know, cinnamon and nutmeg.
And spooky faces.
What did you just say?
Spooky faces. You carve them into
something else.
Okay.
There's pumpkin spice everything.
What a weird word.
Every year about around this time it happens.
Pumpkin. A pumpkin. Pumpkin.
Everything goes pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
Or pumpkin? Should I have said pumpkin pie?
So my mother, who grew up in Ohio on a farm, refuses to acknowledge that there is a second P in the word pumpkin.
Or indeed an M.
Right. Pumpkin pie is the way she insists on it being pronounced. And so I, having been raised in this insanity, will veer from pumpkin to punkin depending on how I'm referring to it. Like, I cannot think of a pumpkin patch without calling it pumpkins. I do not think of a pumpkin patch. I think of pumpkin patches.
Are they different things to you or?
No, a pumpkin patch is where you grow pumpkins. But also, I mean, like, I can talk about pumpkin pie because I guess the alliteration feels good, pumpkin pie, whereas pumpkin pie feels a little bit country. But pumpkin patch definitely is where you grow pumpkins.
I think
my mom can't even say pumpkin. I'll say pumpkin, just say pumpkin, and she'll say pumpkin.
It must be regional, right? Because I know that the great, you know, Hoosier poet James Whitcomb Riley, kind of this famous author of 19th century doggerel, wrote that poem about how the frost is on the pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was trying to be folksy, but maybe that's just how everyone he was writing to would have said it.
Well, that's what folksy is, right? Just them folks saying the thing the way they folks say it.
I assumed it was like a folksy put on, though.
Oh, I see.
Like, I thought he was doing a
dialect
a thing. Yeah.
No, my mom does not indulge in a lot of folksyisms. In fact, she looks back at the Midwest as a backward place she's glad to have left. And she does not say arn her clothes anymore.
Arn?
She doesn't.
Does she wash them before she arns them?
Or arn them, but she did say that growing up. But pumpkin, you can't dislodge her.
I had a teacher who used to say Washington.
Washington. I think she said that too. And you hear that every once in a while, Washington.
They should stop people at the border of Washington
make
state.
Make them say it.
Say the name of the state. If you say Washington or Oregon.
That's right. Go back to Illinois for another 5 years. But I am a big fan of pumpkins and pumpkin pie. I mean,
who isn't?
There's something so wonderful about a pumpkin and the season that it ushers in and the whole time when pumpkins are in the world, on our porches and in our supermarkets and the flavor and smell of pumpkins are around. It's just that it's kind of my favorite time of the year. And I feel a close identification with pumpkins.
Do you identify sexually as a pumpkin? Are you like an otherkin, a pumpkin otherkin?
I have never.
Do you have a fursuit that's a big pumpkin?
I've never felt any sexual attraction to pumpkins, but now that you're, I mean, and I think
what's the sexiest jack-o'-lantern you've ever seen?
If I did have an attraction to pumpkins, I think I would call them pumpkins.
You can't count pumpkins.
I think I'm attracted to pumpkins and not to pumpkins.
Pumpkin rock is bullshit.
That's a hot take.
You can't say that Jack Skellington, the Pumpkin King, is
Well, you can say he's sexy. He is sexy, but he's not really a pumpkin.
Well, we'll get into that.
He's a skeleton who's the king of the pumpkins, which is means he's some kind of oppressive outside ruler.
Yeah, he's a skeleton.
Who's been brought in to rule the pumpkins, even though he is not actually
a But the thing is, pumpkin. A skeleton, if it's animated, can actually accomplish things, where it's very hard for a pumpkin to accomplish anything.
That's true, but surely an animated pumpkin would have the ability to transcend its limitations, just like a real skeleton would not be much of a president or king.
True. And a pumpkin is a vine fruit. So if you incorporate the vines, sure, a vine could be a many-tentacled adversary.
It's interesting how you mentioned you love pumpkins because of the whole season, because it's a weird kind of food in that it's raised as a food crop, but A, we don't actually eat it that much, and B, we just love it for its kind of vague pop cultural associations.
Well, the history of the pumpkin is extremely interesting, right? It's native to the Americas.
Yes, like all squashes.
Like all squashes.
In fact, the word squash is clearly not any kind of European word. Anything in the language that sounds that cool, like squash or skunk,
right?
You know, it's Wampanoag or some American tribe.
Well, and so it was the squashes originated kind of in Central America and in Mexico, and there's a lot of argument about the origins of the various squash species, because they seem to have, in many cases, kind of independently evolved in different locations. But Central America certainly.
So they could be some kind of alien invader. Some kind of
That's right.
They do look like the Body Snatchers pods.
Sure, they dropped down out of. They came off of a meteorite or something, and
the UFOs moved to three-dimensional space just long enough to leave these weird gourds in eight parts of the Americas.
Just bloop, bloop,
and then
bloop.
Just as quickly, and then they drew their giant runway figures.
Yep, and took off into space.
Then they bailed.
They made some mounds. They threw some squash around and then split.
The mounds are just the extra dirt left over from the Nazca carvings. That's my theory.
Oh, really? Even the mounds up in Ohio?
Yeah, they went all the way from Peru to Ohio because they had all that extra dirt.
Yeah.
Where were you going to dump it? They're like, oh, Ohio, it's
Ohio,
flat.
There's nothing up there.
Nothing there, just John's mom talking about pumpkins.
Typical colonial mentality.
Colonial UFOs.
You know what? There were already mounds in Ohio, thank you.
We don't need you UFO colonizers.
But squash were among the earliest domesticated crops. I mean, in the Middle East, they were domesticating rye and other grains in 11,000 BC, but squash.
Why would you start with rye? wheat and rice actually taste good, but we're not ready yet.
Rye.
We're going to start out with rye.
You know why?
Rye.
Because they're bourbon drinkers, the original.
I mean, that's probably true of most grain cultivation, right? It probably did start as something to
make beer with.
Well,
I mean, which is going to be the first thing that you discover, beer or bread? I bet beer.
Well, actually, you know, you say that, but I think there is some evidence that the Egyptians discovered beer because of leaving bread dough out.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, they were using it as a cooking staple, and they realized when it fermented, stuff got fun.
I would think that it would be that the grain, you would pound up the grain and throw it in some water, and it would start to...
Like, you get back, you're a primitive person, hunter-gatherer, you get back from the gym.
Yep.
You pound up some grain and put it in a little shake.
Pounding up grain is the gym in prehistoric times.
Everything's a gym in prehistoric times.
But so the squash was domesticated as a food staple. There are a lot of different kinds of squash, and many of them only, they're hardy in varying degrees. And so they're, a lot of them grow most happily in warm climates with warm summer nights and long seasons.
We should make this clear to the future that botanically, there's really no such thing as a pumpkin, right? Well, like squash, there's a species called the squash, and it's everything from zucchini to, you know, all these different kinds of gourds. But pumpkin is just a word we use for a bunch of squash that have a certain kind of shape and a certain kind of color.
It is hilarious how divisive the squash question is among botanists.
There's a squash question among botanists?
There are a lot of squash questions among botanists because squash...
I'm going to call them squestions.
Squestions. There is such a diversity of squash types.
It's true. They're dark green, they're yellow, they're orange, they're long, they're round, they're big, they're small.
Yep. And some of them are really good and some of them are really bad.
Like they're evil? They do
no,
bad
No, no, no. They're
things?
Just bad tasting. They're
not poisonous, right? They're not like some nightshade plant.
No. But there are a lot of squash species that cannot quite be accounted for in terms of having a single place of genesis. Mm. And some squash are infertile in terms of being able to be crossbred with other squash, and some are not. We're talking about a genus called Cucurbita or Cucurbita. And then within that, there are all the subsets of Cucurbita. So the largest variety of squash fall under the heading Cucurbita pepo. Pepo, or I don't think peepo.
Peepo.
I bet pepo.
Peepo Bryson?
Pepo.
So, and this is most of our food squashes. This is your acorn, your butternut.
Well, so there are edible squashes across the whole panoply of squashes. Pepo can crossbreed with a lot of different squashes, but a lot of other ones it can't. Moschata, Cucurbita moschata, is a really delicious sort of edible squash. It's very separate from pepo, but can be crossbred. There are squashes in the family. Let's see, what are the other ones are Cucurbita fissifolia. Those are more of a South American squash, also edible. A lot of them are cultivated for, like, their flowers are edible. Every part of the squash is edible, right? The flowers, the rind, the seeds, the meat inside.
That's the Indians for you.
That's right. They use every part of the buffalo.
Every part of the squash alo.
There's Cucurbita.
Cucurbita.
Argyrosperma. Let's call it Argyrosperma. These are all angiosperms. So squash are actually a fruit, and they're in the berry family.
Oh, they're just big, big berries.
They're just berries that have kind of evolved a stringy rind instead of a delicious outer.
I'm kind of a person who's developed a stringy rind instead of a delicious outer fruit, so I understand.
Don't want to go all the way into that conversation. But so squash were one of the first foodstuffs brought back from the Americas to Europe after...
Probably because they would survive an ocean voyage,
yeah,
right?
They're hardy, and they were, I'm sure, intriguing.
And they were, because they were alien plants, they were probably mind-controlling the conquistadors or whatever.
That's
like,
right.
Spread us to your continent. Us.
They just wrapped their vines around Pizarro's ankles and were like, take us home.
I will take the squashes back to Spain. That's Pizarro being hypnotized.
Is that...
That's how he would say
it. I am Pizarro.
Soy Pizarro. I will bring you back to España.
There are gourd species from Asia and from Africa, but they are not Cucurbita. They're a separate
genus. I've seen traditional Asian like decor that's carved from gourds, and they'll use them as percussion. And but those are not squashes then.
No, and they were initially, I think, cultivated as drinking vessels, right? They weren't foods, but they were these great sort of instacups. And there is speculation that the squash came from Asian species of gourd that moved with the initial settlers, the initial sort of migrants to the Americas.
They just came in their little rafts or over the Bering Strait with a pocket full of squash seeds and a dream.
Delicious squash cups.
Mm.
But then when they migrated to Europe through the Americas.
Back across the ocean.
They became extremely popular right away in France in particular, and then like over to Britain.
As a culinary thing?
Yeah, because they had this interesting...
Because now we have cups.
We had plenty of cups. You could make cups. Them out of wood. You could make them out of pewter.
Lots of options.
And also, if you wanted a hat, you no longer had to use a gourd as a hat. We had all the new technology. What we didn't have was this delicious, meaty, strange new taste, and you know, the tastes of the new world were all very fashionable in that initial era of exploration.
Nowadays we think of the potato as an Irish staple, and I guess zucchini has an Italian name, but all this stuff came from the Americas.
Including tomatoes, which are...
Tomatoes, yeah. Speaking of marinara sauce.
There's no such thing as Italian cuisine without tomatoes, but in fact...
Everything we have now that has tomato in it, Italians used to just have olive oil and fig juice. I don't know. What would you use instead of tomatoes?
Olives. I mean, olives were everything, presumably.
That's why they're
tomatoes.
Called olives, because all of the food.
Oh.
That's where it comes from.
Oh, that's nice. funny about zucchini... Zucchini is actually a squash that was initially sort of developed in northern Italy as late as the later half of the 19th century.
Oh.
So zucchini is not native to the squash that from whence zucchini came from the Americas, but it was developed in Italy. So zucchini,
if you showed it to an
thing.
Indian tribe, they would be like, we gave you our beautiful squash and you made this
green weird
phallic thing.
There are a lot of different squash. So I think the inhabitants of Mexico and Central America would recognize it as a squash. There were a lot of different weird gooseneck squashes and squashes.
To this day, there are lots of squashes that have zucchini color that are some kind of squash.
Right. But the Native Americans of North America actually received their squash through England. So squash were re-imported to Boston through the Pilgrims.
So at the first Thanksgiving, it was not the Indians bringing the pumpkin pie? It was the Pilgrims?
Correct. And in fact, pumpkin pie itself was developed in the United Kingdom in the 1600s. As a novel way to use this interesting sort of food stuff that came from the Americas. And they started cultivating in France and England these pumpkins and butternut squashes and whatnot, and developed this recipe for a delicious pie cooked out of...
It's a custard in some kind of a
pie crust.
A tart shell, yeah.
The way that you would have eaten squash in the Americas at the time was more of a kind of a soup, like we would, like you would think of a sort of Trader Joe's pumpkin soup.
We still make pumpkin soup, yeah. Right?
So the pie was this innovation that came back to the Americas.
I've seen early recipes where they would be very fancy and make it in the pumpkin gourd itself instead of a pie crust, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, right. Is that what you want? I mean, I think it's like a
bread bowl, I guess.
In the 19th century, there was a phase, I think, where they would, they'd throw, it was kind of like making a turducken. They would throw apples and cinnamon and all kinds of things inside of a pumpkin and bake it as a whole.
It's a turpumpkin. Yeah, there's a Japanese restaurant here in town that will make pumpkin fried rice in the pumpkin that the thing came from.
Really?
And it is kind of like, you know, using the, you know, you kill something and then use its own skeleton. It's kind of like, in your face, pumpkin.
In your face, alien overlords.
Here in town right now, Amazon.com has taken over some of the upper floors of Macy's, a department store it helped put out of business.
Right.
Or is helping put out of business. And I always think, man, that's the most amazing act of one-upsmanship.
Yeah.
To move back into the carcass of your prey.
It's a real hermit crab mentality. Although the hermit crab, I guess the hermit crab could... Did he outcompete the mollusk?
He doesn't eat the old mollusk, right? Like, or maybe he does. Is there some real badass hermit crab?
I think he just waits.
He just
find an empty.
Find a good shell. He's just a house hunter.
Which is not what Amazon's doing. They're just gradually sucking the life out of all department stores.
Imagine some hermit crab house hunters type show where he's like, just looking for a new shell, 5 bedrooms. I need an office. Our budget is $75,000 sand dollars. I dare you to segue from that.
It's very hard. It's very hard to leap off of your house hunters, your shell hunters
imaginary, international. That hilarious comedy premise. You were talking about how early pumpkin pies came from Britain.
Yeah. And they were a very Yankee emblem, right?
When they came to Boston.
Because they became a kind of, like, at least culturally, a thing that we thought of as being like a New England Protestant pie.
I think of it as a cold weather plant. I think because of the frost is on the pumpkin thing. But if a lot of squashes came from Central America and Mexico, that's not really true. It's more cultural than climatic.
Yeah, there are few varieties that can survive like early freezes. So you're limited in what can grow in the northern states. There's certainly a greater variety can grow the further south you go.
I know zucchini can grow anywhere. Like when it's zucchini season in a neighborhood where people have gardens, people will just be leaving zucchini on your back door
because
they're trying to get rid of it.
Because everyone thinks it'll be so great to have a zucchini plant. And then how many zucchinis do you eat in a year?
You just can't eat that much zucchini.
Six maybe if you have a blender.
But pumpkins can thrive in New England. Is that right?
Some varieties of pumpkin can survive. And what we think of as a pumpkin, and this is where the botanists really get all up in one another's business, because there are pumpkins that we think of as the pumpkin, kind of primarily maybe the best known is the Connecticut field pumpkin.
Is that your canonical orange jack-o'-lantern?
That's the orange jack-o'-lantern pumpkin. They tend to grow pretty big. They're not especially delicious, but they're gorgeous, I guess.
Yeah, if they're mostly for carving and decor, you almost don't want it to have a whole lot of filling. You want it to be easy to hollow out and firm. You don't care if the flesh is any good.
Well, they were developed as animal feed. You know, a great thing about squash is that they are hardy. They grow fast. They mature in the summer, and you can keep them in a root cellar, and, you know, cows and hippopotamuses love pumpkins.
Those early Boston settlers had a ton of cattle and hippos.
Hippos and, you know.
Like Pablo Escobar.
Have you been to the pumpkin feeding at the zoo?
Yeah, a lot of zoos do this now, right? They'll use all their old jack-o'-lanterns and toss them to the pandas and the hippos.
Oh, and they just love them. And so they don't have to be particularly sweet for a cow because, you know, they're better than grass, presumably. Meaty, delicious pumpkin.
Fun to crunch on.
Fun to crunch.
It's like a football snack to them.
But the emblem of them as a symbol of the American autumn.
Yeah.
I think as we migrated to cities, like these pumpkins growing as animal feed became a kind of, you know, a sort of romantic symbol of the Middle West.
I know that over the winter, what's it called? Over the river and through the woods, that grandmother's house, you know, which is about going back to your ancestral country, farm, home.
Right.
I think in autumn, it ends, hooray for the pumpkin pie. You know, like that's the symbol of being home at grandma's, is that delicious country pumpkin pie.
Well, so during this period, our pumpkin pie story takes an interesting turn, which is that a man by the name of Elijah Dickinson, who's a very religious Kentucky farmer.
Religious sounding name for sure.
Yeah, Elijah Dickinson.
That guy's strict.
He's a strict Protestant guy. And he uproots his family and decides to move to Illinois to start a new life on the frontier, I guess, the wild, fertile lands of Illinois.
If this guy does not start a pumpkin sex cult, I'm going to be pretty disappointed.
He pretty much does. He takes along with him a lot of his seeds from his Kentucky farm. He's a successful farmer there. And among these seeds are some seeds of a kind of squash, a squash that we wouldn't call a pumpkin necessarily. This is not Cucurbita pepo. This is Cucurbita moschata, which is in the same family as the butternut squash. And his seeds for this sort of what we would look, if you looked at it, you would call it a squash. It's a small.
It's not long like a butternut squash.
But it's not round like a pumpkin either. It's kind of a little, it's like a football sized little squash, which became known as the Dickinson pumpkin. And he moved to Illinois and started cultivating these. And they had a very sweet flavor, and they produced a nice consistency of pumpkin meat. They're good eaten. And the squash at this time, a lot of them were described by people coming from Europe using terms that made sense to them. So the Dickinson pumpkin is actually a strain of squash that was known as the large cheese squash because the squashes were kind of flat and squat and looked like a cheese.
It's a big orange loaf thing, yeah.
And if you look at all the different kinds of squash, so many of them are called cheese. There's probably 25 kinds of like the French cheese and the Kentucky cheese and the Illinois cheese.
They don't taste like cheese.
They don't taste like cheese, but they look like cheese. So Dickinson took the large cheese with him when he went. And he started cultivating them there in Illinois. And very quickly, they were recognized as a delicious kind of pie filling. And the Dickinson family started growing increasingly only these pumpkins because they were kind of monocrop that made them quite a bit of money. They were successful in selling these. And they were early canners of canned pumpkin.
So you would not actually have to scrape out the buy a Dickinson pumpkin, scrape out the inside. Because it takes, I don't know, every time I carve a jack-o'-lantern, I think, how do you go from this to the mush in the can?
So I've talked to my mom about it quite a bit, who's made a lot of pumpkin pies from pumpkins, just your natural field pumpkin.
Really? Not from a can of
And she says that it is an incredibly laborious process. You have to, because it's very stringy meat, sure. You have to basically push it through a sieve and refine the pumpkin meat, you know, through multiple sort of hand processes.
I guess the stuff we buy is probably essentially a puree, right?
It's a puree.
It's been chopped up by a terrible mincing machine.
And a Dickinson pumpkin, being less a pumpkin and more of a butternut squash, is already less stringy. Mm. But so the Dickinson brothers ended up building a big canning company. They became the major producers of canned pumpkin, which is, I think everyone agrees, not really pumpkin. The pumpkins.
It's not what we would usually call a pumpkin, which is that a Connecticut species.
Right. And again, the botanists, there's not a lot going on in botany, I think, in terms of like where like fists can get thrown. I don't think when you go to botany conventions, there's a ton of like people throwing drinks in one another's faces. But wading into the writing about it, I found some extremely long passages of disagreement about what, because a pumpkin is a squash, but a squash isn't a pumpkin. They're all fruits.
Is it respectful disagreement or run high?
I think that there is some controversy and it starts when you say, because it's been popular in recent years for food bloggers and BuzzFeed style internet conspiracy generators to say, you'll never guess what's in your pumpkin pie. Hint, it's not pumpkin. And then Gwyneth Paltrow or whatever flops down on her fainting couch and goes, I'm being poisoned. I mean, you know, it's a kind of popular
thing now. Is that this is just a squash.
It's not a pumpkin. You've been eating squash pie the whole time.
I think my mom has actually made pumpkin pie with a different kind of maybe she couldn't get pumpkin when we lived overseas, so she would make it with some other kind of canned squash. And I thought it was essentially indistinguishable because, and you're probably going to want to get into this, the custard in a pumpkin pie does not taste like pumpkin so much. It tastes like cinnamon and cloves and ginger and allspice and nutmeg.
Right. And the recipe for all those spices, it harkens back to England in the 1600s.
It's true. That's a straight up list of what you would put on your suckling pig with an apple in its mouth,
right,
or whatever.
Cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, cloves. Allspice being another kind of berry from a pimenta plant, which was similarly kind of discovered during this era of exploration.
Is it New World or is it like Southeast Asia?
It's New World also. And
it's what you put in Jamaican jerk, right, stuff. That's all allspice.
It's still very popular. In fact, allspice became one of the great exports of the New World cuisine. It became incredibly important in Indian food, in the food of the Middle East. You taste allspice. In some cases, it's the primary spice of like a whole handful of global cuisine.
They must have, I think they named it that way because they thought it tasted like a blend. It's a mélange of cinnamon and nutmeg and cloves.
Yeah, it tasted just like what you would get if you put those three together. So except, one-stop shop.
Except then why do you still put cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves in pumpkin pie? You should just put in allspice.
Well,
it's so
I
much
feel
simpler.
Like you, it, because allspice has predetermined the blend.
Ah, you need a different proportion.
Yeah, if you want a little bit more clove in your taste, you put in, you can add that separately.
I assume there must be different levels to the taste of cinnamon and nutmeg and cloves that allspice actually does not capture, or basically we would have just replaced everything with allspice by now.
Yeah, and I think you taste allspice in halal food or you taste it in Indian food, and it is, in the cases where it's the main flavor, mm-hmm, you really get a sense of like what allspice's capacities are. It could not suffice as the sole flavoring of pumpkin pie because pumpkin pie would taste like lamb vindaloo.
It would taste like jerk chicken. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right. And it's also, it's a component in moles. I mean, it's very popular all around.
So it seems like pumpkin is the least important thing in a pumpkin pie, then.
Well, and also a pumpkin pie has like heavy cream, eggs, and sugar.
Sure.
Which are the three ingredients that I would like to see in all foods.
In the movie Pulp Fiction, pumpkin pie is actually used as a symbol of deliciousness. When yes. Samuel Jackson says, you know, sewer rat might taste like pumpkin pie, but I wouldn't eat the filthy mother ever. To him, there's nothing more delicious he can imagine than pumpkin pie. It has nothing to do with pumpkin. It's eggs, cream, and spices.
Well, and there is in within the United States a real North-South divide around the idea of pumpkin pie.
Yes. Jules should say sweet potato pie, that's not right. Pumpkin pie, right?
Because in 1860 or 61, Abe Lincoln declared Thanksgiving a national holiday.
Yeah, it's during the Civil War, for sure.
During the Civil War. And the South really rejected the idea. They considered it a kind of propaganda device. And the connection between pumpkin pie and the North and the story of the Pilgrims.
It's New England. They're like, this is Yankee culture.
That's right. They feared that the pumpkin pie was an attempt to colonize their local, their regional cuisine. And so they responded with
sweet potato pie.
That's right. Sweet potato pie.
Which what did not exist, or was it a, it was not concocted just to stick it to Lincoln.
No, but it was elevated in stature as
this is our equivalent.
That's right. The official pie of the South. And even when pumpkin pies were made in the South, they had other ingredients, Southern ingredients like bourbon were added to the Southern pumpkin pie to make it theirs.
Possum meat. That's a little bit of roadkill.
Cotton was the number one thing they added to their delicious sweet potato pie.
I mean, to
pie.
Be fair, the North and the South are at war at this point. So Lincoln can't really make them celebrate a holiday any more than FDR could have made the Nazis celebrate Purim.
Right.
It doesn't have a lot of legislative force.
No, but that was a common thing in the North to describe all of their stuff as the Union, right? I mean, they were the Union Army. They weren't talking about the Union of the Northern States. They were talking about the Union of both sides.
And they weren't wrong. When the country was reunified, all those Southerners had to suck it up and have Thanksgiving.
They did.
And they hated every second. They're like, I don't want to eat this turkey.
Well, I think we think of pumpkin pie as being a foodstuff of the Middle West and the South even.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it feels like such a Southern food. And I'm not sure how much that prejudice still exists in the South, whether there is a residual suspicion of pumpkin pie and Thanksgiving.
As a rule of thumb, I would think that stuff like that, that kind of resentment does linger in the South longer than you would expect, right?
But how do you resist a delicious pumpkin pie?
It's the truth story. I mean, I wish I liked sweet potato pie better because I feel like that's the more authentic thing. You want that to get that at a soul food restaurant.
Right.
But I prefer pumpkin pie to sweet potato pie.
Absolutely, you do. And part of that is a result of the Dickinson brothers who commercialized their operation and to such a degree that they became the main purveyors of pumpkin filling for whatever use you might have for it.
They corner the market. They're like the Doles or whatever.
And then right before the economic collapse in 1929, the Dickinson brothers kind of foresee the economic lay of the land, and they sell out. They sell to the Libby Corporation right before the crash. But Libby is able to then really mechanize their system, really institute quality control, and they become a canned Libby pumpkin.
To this day, it seems like that's the canonical pumpkin, right?
Do they
still produce most of the world's pumpkin?
They do. So Libby continued to locate themselves there in that region of Illinois. The region where the Dickinson brothers originally kind of settled and built their factory, which is the area around Morton, Illinois.
I don't know where Morton, Illinois is.
So Morton, Illinois is like right in the middle of the state of Illinois. It's close to Peoria. It's kind of between Peoria and Bloomington.
And Peoria, of course, the metaphorical center of America.
That's right.
Will it play in
USA,
Peoria?
America, Peoria. Even to this day, 85% of all pumpkin foodstuffs made in America are grown and processed within 80 miles of Morton, Illinois.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
That nobody else was like, we'll start a competing pumpkin farm.
Well, so Libby keeps a hold of the Dickinson pumpkin seeds. They don't just like let anybody take them and grow them.
It's a trade secret.
And it's a kind of a monocultivar there to such a degree that there was a bad year in 2009-2010 where it disadvantageously rained during a certain part of the season and the entire—
Just on Morton, Illinois, right?
Just right in this area, and it destroyed the entire crop, or it destroyed a large portion of the crop that year, which caused a run on the canned pumpkin market driving the price of canned pumpkin.
I do remember paying $180 for a can of pumpkin that year.
Through the roof. Because if you're like, look, Thanksgiving's here and I need to make this pumpkin pie. And this is, I mean, they had the market cornered and they lost their whole crop.
That's the year to just make it with acorn squash or whatever, like my mom did.
Learn how to do sweet potato pie.
Nobody will complain.
After 2009, the Libby Company realized that they needed to diversify where they were growing Dickinson pumpkins. So they you know, bought land elsewhere. But as of just recently, it's estimated that there are 5,000 acres of land in cultivation growing these Dickinson pumpkins, which produce about between 10 and 15 million pumpkins. Which
it's amazing, right? A few thousand acres, you can just get all the pumpkin the world needs.
Because they can grow really close together. They sow a lot of seeds. They're, you know, these pumpkin fields are just like proliferating.
There's no elementary school field trips out to the pumpkin patch to do a hayride.
Oh, I think whatever. You can go out to them, but you just can't, you know, you can't. I think that Libby actually lets some workers there take some pumpkins home, but not many. They really do keep a fence around the – it's a major cash crop. It's worth about $100 million a year, the pumpkin crop.
Is that an autumnal thing, by the way, for your family? Do you take your daughter to a pumpkin patch
absolutely,
every year?
Absolutely.
Corn maze? Is there a corn maze?
Go to the corn maze. Last year we went to a corn maze, but the ground was so muddy that we got out into the corn maze and then you're like – ankle deep in mud and you can't get out.
Your daughter's still there.
And we're saying like, which way to the exit? And all the other people like mud smeared on their faces. It was pretty traumatic.
When my kids were little, we went out to one up north of Seattle that has not just a corn maze, not just a hayride, not just a pumpkin patch, but also some kind of pig show where they do a recreation of the story of the three little pigs with actual piglets who maybe do not want to get pushed into this race. I can't remember who the wolf is. But yeah,
it's not an actual wolf.
There's no actual. Yeah. You need three new piglets every show. Like these little piglets are placed into their respective houses, twigs, straw, and brick.
Right.
And you have to watch a little. It's like the passion play.
Is the wolf like a 7-year-old kid in a wolf costume, or how does the play get
enacted? The wolf may be like a collie or something. Like obviously these pigs cannot act. You cannot train a pig to act out the story of the three little pigs.
We have no idea whether the futurelings listening are
they super intelligent.
They're all like Shakespearean actor pigs who are like, oh, really? Can you not teach a pig to act?
Well, listen, you
sir,
non-kosher listeners, your ancestors in our day were not great actors. I'm sorry to say. But the kids to this day talk about the pig show, which is a big part of their autumn heritage.
I feel like I went to... Maybe it wasn't this year, but I've definitely seen like a greased pig competition at the Puyallup Fair.
I thought you were going to say in a pumpkin patch in October. That would be.
I think it's a fair activity. Yeah. They put a bunch of kids in there and grease up a pig, and everyone laughs as a bunch of 7-year-olds are humiliated.
It was the first video game.
I want at the fair this year. We watched the sheep races.
Yeah, they put them on sheep. It's like bucking broncos, but with sheep.
Little
right?
kids. They like put them on the back of a sheep, and then they whack the sheep on the ass, and the kid's supposed to hold on as long as they can. There were some kids that are just getting trampled.
Well, yeah, the kids can go flying, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they either go flying or they slip off and fall underneath this panicked sheep. I mean, it was great fun. Look, it was great American fun and everybody was fine.
Everybody except the kid was fine.
I was proud to be an American because at least I know I'm free.
America's all about democracy and the will of the majority. And most of the people there had a good time. Maybe the child didn't, but...
But the child learned an important lesson, which is do not trust their father. When their father tells them that he's going to take them to the fair.
When he says it's going to be a wild and woolly time, it might literally be a wild and woolly time.
So the Libby sold their operation, the Dickinson pumpkin operation, to Nestle.
Oh, there's some big evil European overlord now that owns American Pumpkin.
And American, like Big Pumpkin now is some French conglomerate. But they, which is maybe not inappropriate given that the French were the first Europeans to really embrace the squash as a culinary
as a gourmet
ingredient.
Treat.
Yeah. But then Nestle spun off their canned pumpkin division, and it's still Libby Pumpkin. pumpkin stuffs, which is what we all still use today. Now, that what became the canonical pumpkin pie recipe, although it had percolated back from its roots in the United Kingdom, during the 20th century, there was not any one agreed upon formula for making an American pumpkin pie.
It would differ regionally or by family.
And so one of the Dickinson brothers came home one evening and said, you know what we need is to put a pumpkin pie recipe on the can.
People were just drinking it. People were just opening up and drinking it straight from the can. They didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, they were mixing it into their breakfast cereal. They were putting it in their coffee.
Brushing their teeth with it.
Which we'll get to in a minute.
Oh, that's true.
But a grandmother, a wife of one of these old Dickinson brothers by the name of Hazel Dickinson, sat in her kitchen and baked a dozen pumpkin pies from various recipes she accumulated from all of her neighbors and friends, and had a pumpkin pie tasting contest among her family. Like, everybody come in and taste these pies. And the best one, she wrote the recipe down, and it was printed on the back of a can of Libby pumpkin meat.
And it's the one that's still there to this day.
And pretty much every person that has an individual recipe, like a family recipe for pumpkin pie, it derives from Hazel Dickinson's pie recipe. People then start changing the proportions, but it's a Dickinson, what we think of as pumpkin pie, the one that I fed you the other day.
It's a corporate recipe.
It all came from this little grandmother who now has become sort of the Colonel Sanders of American pumpkin pies. We're not even sure if she was a real person. She's just a
she's like Betty Crocker now. She's an idea.
Old lady.
I think I've told you this, that my mom always made her pumpkin pie just exactly to match the back of the Libby's can.
Yeah.
And to this day, I think of that as the only kind of pumpkin pie that should be made, to the degree that, like, I will get a nicer pumpkin pie from a neighborhood bakery or even Costco.
Throw it down the stairs, throw it in the toilet.
Yeah. And I will just, no, but I'll take a bite and I'll be like, this is fine, but it's not as good as my mom's pumpkin pie, which is just the can recipe.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's actually true or if my tastes have just evolved from what Hazel Dickinson told me to like.
Well, and for instance, Libby still insists that condensed sweetened canned milk is the cream that you need to use in a pie.
That's what my mom uses. And I bet these posher ones are actually using heavy cream.
They sure are. The posh people are like, no, you want to replace that with like hand churned American cream butter or whatever.
You do not want that, in my opinion.
And what you need for the true American pie is a can of Borden's, which is also, spoiler alert, owned by Nestle.
It's synergy.
Yeah, you want that can of sweetened condensed milk. And well, I don't know the last time.
That's very British. Like, the British love their sweetened condensed milk. They made the Indians and the Pakistanis eat sweetened condensed milk. Now they all just love condensed milk on bread.
I mean, I haven't had a can of sweetened, and it's not like I ever drank an entire can, but I have not tasted sweetened condensed milk in a while, but it is a flavor of my childhood for sure.
Would you guys just eat it on bread? Are you like
No, we didn't put it on bread, but that was what we used in cooking. I mean, my mom used sweetened condensed milk for a lot of different things. I think when you get a Thai iced tea, it's basically, or is that sweetened condensed coconut milk? No, it's sweetened condensed milk.
They use coconut milk a lot, but I think condensed milk is still popular in lots of parts of South Asia and the subcontinent because of the colonizers.
Well, so now we're living in a world where pumpkin spice has become a kind of cultural phenomenon.
It's autumn, like,
it's time for pumpkin spice candles and pumpkin spice pizza. And
guess what day Starbucks started the pumpkin spice latte this year?
What day?
August 28th.
You could start getting a pumpkin spice latte in August.
Which really stretches the definition of autumnal.
Ugh. So I think
almost a full month into summer.
I think McDonald's pioneered this many, 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 many years ago when they started doing a shamrock shake.
Is that the birth of seasonal prepared food?
That's what I think of. I imagine there's probably, at least on a scale of this sort of mass produced
nationwide
food culture, Remember, McDonald's had McRib for a while. They would put out these kind of seasonal.
What holiday was that for?
The McRibs had to be for
Arbor Day.
Yeah.
Plant a tree and eat a McRib. That was that.
Arbor Day. And Arbor Day suggests exactly how much rib meat is actually in a McRib sandwich, which is to say not very much. But in 2003, Starbucks was trying out some different seasonal flavors. They'd had some success with their peppermint latte that was kind of a Christmas flavor, and they were throwing around some ideas. And someone came up with pumpkin spice as a latte flavoring. And the Starbucks executives were a little bit sort of dubious about it, although there wasn't a lot else that was pumpkin flavored in the world at the time.
Well, also, all those things are things you would not be surprised to find in hot drinks. Cinnamon,
right.
Cloves, right. Ginger, nutmeg. These are all things you will find in different kinds of teas and hot chocolates and eggnogs.
But no one was thinking, let's put pureed pumpkin in a cup of coffee.
Does
right?
pumpkin spice latte have any pumpkin in it, or is it just the spice?
So the initial pumpkin spice lattes that came out in 2003 did not have any pumpkin in them. They were just, as you describe, a combination of the
holiday spice
pumpkin
mix.
Flavors, yeah. Right? And like all great lattes, full of heavy cream that, and with enough sugar syrup in there, probably tastes like sweetened condensed milk. But pumpkin spice lattes were a huge success. They, even in their initial debut, sold out massively and were...
Well, here's the thing. Everybody loves pumpkin pie. Right. You only eat it like maybe 2 days a year. Like you traditionally, you would have a pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving and then some leftovers and maybe Christmas and then some leftovers. And at some point, somebody was like, there is an untapped appetite for people want this taste more than 2 days a year. Why would we only... Why would we deprive ourselves?
I certainly do. Like, there were many, many years where I had my first piece of pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving.
Me too.
And then, you know, if you were lucky, you'd get one on Christmas dinner too. And then you bid adieu to the pumpkin taste until the following year.
What if we did that with chocolate? That would be insane.
Yeah. And I think when I reached like my full franchise as an adult, I realized, as soon as I see a pumpkin pie in the store, I can buy it. I don't have to wait till Thanksgiving.
I started doing that with eggnog, and then you can gain 30 pounds with this
plan. You love
nog.
I knew that about you.
Are you anti-nog?
I don't eat the nog.
Did you say I don't eat the nog dog?
I don't eat the nog dog.
Dog? I don't eat it either, but I will drink it. Mm-hmm. I will not cut eggnog with Fresca like my grandpa used to, because that's disgusting.
Whoa.
But I will cut it with a little milk, and it's delicious.
People put liquor in eggnog.
They do.
I never did when I was a liquor consumer, because why waste?
Why ruin rum with egg yolks?
Right. No dice. But I do buy pumpkin pies. I try not to eat like 50 pumpkin pies in the autumn, but I keep one around. It's a delicious breakfast. I gave my daughter a slice of pumpkin pie for breakfast the other day, and I might as well have made her princess of the world. She couldn't believe her good fortune.
I mean, that's the best thing about Thanksgiving is the day after the pie has been in the fridge all night, yeah. Delicious triangle of breakfast pumpkin pie. But the Starbucks latte phenomenon it did not sate our appetite for pumpkin spice. It only sharpened it.
It did. It people realized like they love this flavor. And I think other people commercial enterprises saw the success that Starbucks had with pumpkin spice latte, and they searched around like, what about zucchini? What about hot dog flavor? And they realized like, oh, you know what? We can just do a pumpkin thing too. People aren't, you know, they'll have their pumpkin spice latte and then they'll come into our store and we'll sell them some pumpkin spice pierogi whatever.
It just gives you an excuse. Like, you weren't going to buy Oreos, right? Because they're a blind spot. Oreos are always there on the shelf. And then suddenly, what?
Whoa.
These Oreos are pumpkin spice.
I have to get them.
Here's a list of products that you can now get in pumpkin spice form in our era. Do you want me to go through
please.
This?
Please. My goodness.
Coffee Mate, Cheerios, Philadelphia cream cheese, pumpkin spice Quaker oatmeal, Pop-Tarts. There's your breakfast. Chobani yogurt, Milano's.
Okay, I love Milano's, but I don't
need... Do you remember when Milano's tasted like pumpkin spice? Because Pepperidge Farm remembers.
I need pumpkin in them.
That seems weird. Yeah, when it's chocolate plus popcorn, I'm a little skeptical. Pumpkin-flavored kettle corn? Pumpkin spice-flavored Lando Lakes butter.
What would you make with that?
I think it's just a spread. You're going to eat some bread and butter, but now it's like you just kind of tossed in some sugar and spice and everything nice. Mm-hmm. What did I not say? M&M's? Pumpkin right. spice M&M's?
I've seen those. Avoid.
A little suspicious.
Yep.
Do they have, I think they're no chocolate. Maybe they're double like avoid. White chocolate.
Quadruple avoid.
Blue Diamond almonds okay. with pumpkin spice.
Okay.
Triscuits.
Whoa.
To me, that's the bridge too far. That's like the scientists that were so busy asking, can we do this? They never asked, should we?
Pumpkin Triscuits. I almost feel like buying a box for us just to weigh in on this controversy.
I think we should buy a ton of them and then just blow them up at a baseball game, like Disco Demolition. Because there has been a backlash, right?
Well,
to the pumpkin spice phenomenon.
In 2014, so they were introduced in 2003 and...
The lattes,
pumpkin lattes, and they were a smashing success. But in recent years, 2014, a woman named Vani Hari... the great-great-granddaughter of Mata Hari.
Yes, obviously.
Who is a food blogger who writes under the name The Food Babe. She stirred up some controversy about the pumpkin spice latte, specifically that it had too much sugar, it had caramel coloring, which was going to turn your children into...
little orange...
Yeah, Oompa Loompas. Even though these things were not... considered dangerous by the Food and Drug Administration, that no longer matters if you are someone who's reading like...
Sure, it's far from organic,
right.
GMO locally grown stuff to buy a Starbucks pumpkin spice latte.
And I don't know the work of Vani Hari. She may be doing great work in the world, but she did not do great work by the Starbucks company because she stirred up a lot of pumpkin spice suspicion.
I think it did become kind of a class thing where you had people like Martha Stewart and Anthony Bourdain saying, essentially, pumpkin spice latte is for basic bitches. You know,
yeah,
like
that's right.
If you're not a dumb white woman, why would you be drinking this swill? There's better stuff available.
And it did become synonymous. You're absolutely right, with a sort of housewifey obliviousness. But that did not diminish its appeal. And Starbucks responded by introducing a little bit of pumpkin puree into their pumpkin spice lattes.
Oh, bringing it all back home.
And they, you know, they changed the amount of sugar. They changed the amount of artificial ingredients. They made it now sort of all natural and including real pumpkin or Dickinson pumpkin,
which is, as
we know, a squash, like a butternut squash, basically. It's butternut squash latte. But so, yeah, Starbucks regained their market share after the Vani Hari... years.
After Vani Hari Gate?
And, you know, I'm afraid that pumpkin spice lattes outlived Anthony Bourdain, too, and and Martha Stewart's influence.
I've actually seen backlash to the backlash. People saying...
Oh, that it was snobs?
Yeah, it's snobbery to deny, you know, a nice working class soccer mom her pumpkin spice latte.
Right.
And also maybe there's a level of misogyny, you know, like this is food that is encoded as feminine. It's very easy for... but you guys like us to sit around and laugh at the pumpkin spice chobani, but that's just kind of an encoded way to say this food's a little bit suspect to us.
I think
it's girl
we have,
food.
I think we've crossed a line in the pumpkinization of American food, which is that you cannot ever put the pumpkin back in
the pumpkin back in the bottle.
Yeah. I think that now, you know, pumpkin flavoring and pumpkin as a way of
life.
As a way of life and as a way of like seasoning has taken on such a life of its own that we'll gradually forget its Starbucks connection. Our futurelings listening to the program, living in an entirely pumpkin-based culinary society where everything is from the pumpkin.
I would like to assume that maybe they have a short time every year when they're allowed to buy non-pumpkin spice products.
See.
Like everybody can't wait for the non-pumpkin spice lattes and yogurts and Triscuits.
Sometime in May when the last pumpkins have sort of degraded in their cellars, but before the first pumpkins of the year.
And there's a few cranky ones being like, non-pumpkin spice lattes come earlier every year.
You know what? I really am looking forward to some good old-fashioned corn syrup.
And that concludes... Pumpkin Pie, entry 1008.JH0406, certificate number 36525, in the omnibus. One of the chief ways the pumpkin spice vector or meme spread was through social media, of course. People wanted to post something lifestyle-y.
Post a picture of themselves with the first pumpkin spice latte of the year.
A certain kind of fall ethos or aesthetic. The whole pumpkin and cornucopia thing. And so that became... That's really how it spread.
That is. That's how Facebook became so popular. It was like a mutual dependence, right? The latte needed Facebook, and Facebook needed the latte.
Yeah, it was a bunch of college students who just wanted a way to rank the pumpkin varieties at their college, and they created Facebook.
People don't realize that Zuckerberg was a botanist.
John and I, as much as we love pumpkin, deplore every other use to which social media is put, and it's a real chore for us to maintain our presences on at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, and at Omnibus Project, respectively. But we do. We soldier on with our impeccably posed morning photos of us with our steaming pumpkin spice lattes.
It's another day in paradise, Ken. Before we start working on Christmas decorating our house.
Yeah, when are you going to start putting up your gingerbread house photos, your little German Christmas village?
Well, I had an advent calendar on the mantle, and I just never took it down. It was up there for like 3.5 years before.
Did you open a door occasionally?
Yeah, every once in a while. Every once in a while I'd walk past and be like, oh, huh, that's right. It's almost Christmas. Good thing that's still there. I had, I don't know if you remember, but I had Christmas stockings hanging on my fireplace all year round.
That's because you wanted to keep the peace on earth and goodwill toward men in your heart.
I like to keep the Christmas spirit alive.
Three ghosts appeared to you. The ghost of Jim Morrison, the ghost of Bobby Kennedy, and the ghost of...
Count Basie.
Patrick Nagel. All appeared to you and wanted you to change the air of your ways and leave your Christmas stockings up all year.
Yes.
And become a kinder human being.
I've done all those things.
The promise came true.
Yeah.
You saved Tiny Tim's leg. Everything's great. We encourage you to interact with your fellow future listeners on the Futurelings fan page on Facebook. It's really the only thing you should do on Facebook. Just go to Facebook, hang out with Futurelings, then close that window.
That's all you need is the Futurelings and Facebook Marketplace, where you sell your RVs and stuff. I'm sure there's like a dating aspect to it too, right?
No, you can use the marketplace for that.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, there it is.
You can use the Futurelings for that.
Definitely do not post anything political there. Do not try and take on your relatives. My brother Bart has started to put videos of choral music, like people singing...
Like Handel's Messiah.
Yeah, right, in European churches.
The three ghosts must have appeared to him too.
It's really wonderful. I go there for a little respite. And then there's some Gregorian stuff. I mean, it's like vocal music in churches.
Back in the day, you would have to wait for carolers.
Yep.
Somebody would have to come to your door and sing choral music.
Good rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay.
It's a little low. It's a little low for me, John.
Remember Christ our Savior.
It's like a minor key Christmas dirge.
Born on Christmas
You have a Christmas day. Album. You should plug it. Buy John's Christmas record.
I made a Christmas album
with
Jonathan Colton called One Christmas at a Time. It's all original compositions, brand new Christmas music that you've never heard before if you don't own the album.
And they're all about the birth of Christ. It's like one of those Christian Archie comics.
Well, we set some limitations on ourselves. We decided we would not use the word Mary. We would not use the word
Mary
cheer.
Like the mother of God, or Mary like
either.
It's a Merry Christmas.
Either. You cannot say I was feeling merry. You cannot say we had good cheer. We took a lot of the normal Christmas tropes out.
What about eggnog?
We do reference eggnog.
Yes.
We talk a lot about like drunk uncles and other lesser known holiday tropes.
So you're telling your listeners you took Jesus out of Christmas and replaced him with eggnog and drunk uncles?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Fair enough.
No, we might refer to Jesus. No, I guess we don't really. I mean, obliquely. There's a hat tip,
shout out to Jesus.
What's up, yo?
Couldn't have done this record without him. But there's a but.
Let me tell you. Here comes
don't worry,
the banjos.
John. I'm sure he'll save you obliquely.
Yeah, listen,
because you mentioned him obliquely.
If you are listening to this program and you are looking for more Christ in your Christmas music, there are plenty of options for you.
Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
But that's right. And I'm sure the works of the entire...
The formerly Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
That's right. It's not Mormon anymore, Ken. But also every music that has come out of Nashville in the last 24 years is probably would be more Christmas carol-y than One Christmas at a Time by John Roderick and Jonathan Colton.
I feel like Nashville really embraced the secular Christmas carols, actually.
The secular ones?
Sure. Silver Bells or whatever. Except not Silver Bells, because that's Christmas time in the city, and they hate the city.
I don't think you're maybe listening to all the Christmas music that's coming out of Nashville. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but you don't seem like you've got your Spotify tuned to...
I don't have my ear to the Opry.
Contemporary Christian...
Would I really
rock.
Be surprised at how Christian-y these
I bet you
the Carrie Underwood Christmas records?
I bet you there's a lot more Christian-y rock music getting made right now than is crossing your bow. Because you're still sitting and listening to the old Frank Black records from the early 90s.
He never had a Christmas record. Are there any Hanukkah songs on these country albums?
No.
Absolutely
not.
Sound of gun being cocked.
Maybe one, maybe that what was the record? It was like a country star made a record with
a rapper.
Yeah, what was that? It was some kind of like let's bring our country together type of record that everybody agreed was both a commercial and a creative failure. But they might have had like a Christmas meets Kwanzaa song. Probably still didn't make any reference to Hanukkah.
If there's one thing a lot of country stars and a lot of rap stars can agree on, it's anti-Semitism. Who was that? Why can't I remember who that
is?
It was Nelly and Tim McGraw.
No.
Jay-Z and Blake Shelton.
No. Who was the... He was one of the
it
early...
It was Ludacris
he was one of the early Dirks rappers Bentley. Who became an actor.
It was
but
Ice
It wasn't
tea.
Ice anybody.
It was LL Cool J. No, was it?
LL Cool J is hard as hell. He'll battle anybody. He don't care who you
it's
tell.
It's Tone Loc and Garth Brooks, but not actually cool Garth Brooks. J it's his rock and roll
country
persona
album, and it
which
was,
is
come on,
you know
baby,
Chris
bring
Gaines,
it home. Brad Paisley, featuring LL Cool J in their tune Accidental Racist.
Right.
Oh, and it references Starbucks. To the man who waited on me at the Starbucks down on Main, I hope you understand. When I put on that t-shirt, the only thing I meant to say is I'm a Skynyrd fan. The red flag on my chest somehow is like the elephant in the corner of the South.
Mm,
and I just...
I'm not sure I'm on the same page as that metaphor.
I just walked him right in the room, like just a proud rebel son with an old can of worms, looking like I got a lot to learn, but from my point of view. How you learn either, is just learn from your point of view.
It's like one of those things where they have a deep learning big data thing and they tossed in a ton of Christmas and rap lyrics and it just spit that out.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't actually make any sense.
They talk about Reconstruction in this tune too.
Are they for it or against it?
Well...
One is for it.
Let's see.
One is against it.
I think they were both supposed to be for whatever they were talking about. There's a lot of talking. I think the Brad Paisley character says, "I'm just a white man coming to you from the Southland," multiple times in this song. That seems to be his...
That's the hook for him.
That's his refrain. And then...
And LL Cool J is just like, F you, cracker.
LL Cool J says, "Dear Mr. White Man, I wish you understood."
If I ever see Brad Paisley in person, I'm going to say, "Dear Mr. White
Dear
Man."
Dear Mr. White Man. And strangely, "Dear Mr. White Man," it's all capitalized.
Mr. Like, White Man, bring, 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 bring me a dream.
I wish you understood.
Is this
what
an
the world is really like when you're living in the hood?
Is this an experiment to see how many people can get to tune out of the outro?
Oh, are we still doing the show?
People say they will listen to this no matter how long it gets, but I think we have maybe reached the point where they will not.
I was thinking that Corinthian was probably going to cut most of this out, but I don't know.
Well, if you're hearing this, Corinthian, sure let you down.
Did you give them all the information?
I didn't do the email address. If you have
get your work done.
If you want to talk to us about Brad Paisley or Ladies Love Cool James or Garth Brooks's rock alter ego,
Chris Gaines.
Ladies Love Chris Gaines. You can email us at omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com. People in our time even sent us physical objects. They would send us Christmas gifts, hand-knitted Christmas stockings, cans of condensed milk. They would put all those in the U.S. mail, and one of those Grumman LLVs would deliver it to Omnibus Project at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Futurelings, at some point in your wonderful, amazing future, podcasts will just end rather than dribble out like an incontinent older gentleman. In your, from our vantage point, and you're just in past, this is great content.
This is as good as it got in our era.
Yeah, we really think that we're
making... This is an amazing bit of sustained improv.
Some tight shit here.
This is a herald, as we say.
You know, there are a lot of stand-up comics doing podcasts, but they can't get the LPM, or laughs per minute, that Ken and I do just...
It's amazing that we produce a new hour of material twice a week, and it's our outro. Choke on that, Louie.
Anyway, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long this outro survives, how long this outro keeps going. We could only be the beginning.
I can talk about Chris Gaines for another half hour if you want.
But we hope and pray that this podcast may one day come to a close. If the worst comes soon... This recording, like all our recordings, may be our final one. But Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Is that entry very long?
When we got done with the show, we were at like 53 minutes, and now perfect. We're at an hour 11.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.